Suddenly I heard a strange but sweet voice calling me, and opening my eyes I saw a beautiful woman in gleaming white robes, bending over me and pleading with me to come with her. She was not like anyone else that I had ever seen. She was so frail, so sweet, so strangely beautiful. I raised myself and started to go with her, but almost before I knew it she had vanished before my eyes. This worried me so that I was never at rest about it. I saw her often in my dreams, but coming to the conclusion that it was one of those white-capped nurses disguised and trying to play a trick on me, I grew to hate her and she came no more, but in her stead came another, radiantly beautiful, but dark and strong looking, and as she walked it was like the crawling of a snake, so willowy and supple was she. She had a head crowned with hair as black as midnight, and it fell around her like some deep storm cloud. She told me so many nice things that I forgot all the noise that I had heard in the streets, and oftentimes when she laughed her black eyes would glitter like beads. But one day as we walked together through the grounds with one of the house nurses, my beautiful companion told me that she had not been telling me the truth and that she had thought I would surely see it after a while. I was amazed, and questioning her I saw an awful evil light creep into her face, and she smiled as I looked at her, smiled her terrible smile right into my soul and maddened me. I kept gazing into her face. I could not turn away, for her dark eyes full of their strange fire held me. But she sank from my sight just as the other one had done, and when I next remembered I was in my own room in bed, and I was very ill. The nurse told me I had been unconscious, but not dangerous. I could not see anyone in the room but the house nurse, and this worried me greatly. Had they forsaken me, my servants whom I had deemed so faithful? They had a thousand commingled emotions wrought on my sensibilities, but the nurse told me I was better and hoped I might see my husband soon. My husband, she spoke of my husband. As if I had a husband. All that I felt conscious of at this time was that I had been very ill, was very ill, and that because I had suddenly grown more restful and quiet, the nurse thought I was almost well. How little after all do those who are trained for a lifetime know of sickness and death. But I lay quite ill at ease, nothing seemed to be quite right, until after a few hours my faithful servants came back to me, and passed like pale specters between the nurse and myself. She did not know they were there even, they walked so gently and spoke in such low tones. If she had been conscious of their presence she would have driven them away. But we fooled and deceived her nicely. Why not? Was she not deceiving me? When I made demands she heeded them not, neither looked at nor answered me. Oh, the cruelty of it! I told her often enough indeed that I wished to go to my native home in India, and adjust matters there, for there were most assuredly some commissions there that I had left unfulfilled, for I had been snatched most suddenly and cruelly away. I felt sure she thought my undone tasks amounted to naught whatever, for she was always silent when I spoke of them, except that sometimes she would say, in a dreary monotone, "Rest now and sleep, and when you are stronger you shall go home and do what you will." Rest until I grew stronger, the very idea. I got to thinking of her words until they began to burn me like fire, and just to show her, one day how strong I was, I flew from my bed and grasping her by the shoulders I threw her instantly backwards and down under my feet, all the while proclaiming my strength. Two other house nurses came running in, and some men in blue suits with burnished buttons took her away from me, and if you'll believe it, locked me again alone in my apartment. I was so helpless in the awful misery of my detainment that I sank down and prayed for help. Soon I lapsed into a strange state of apathy, and then I felt perfectly at rest. I was not able to move any member of my body or even exercise my vocal organs to speak, yet I felt now all suddenly different, and withal, very much better than I had for years. All things began to be clear to me now, and it was now no trouble for me to recognize my own identity perfectly. And I remembered having felt that I was the Indian princess, and that now that same strange feeling was only a vain delusion. I could see no more the pale and horrid specters of the past. I had been insane. I knew now that I could look back on my pitiful condition. Now, just now, if I could but speak or move, if I could but prove the restoration of my normal senses, how much it would mean to me. But alas, I could not. It was the useless body now in place of the scattered brain. Oh, but I did make such a valiant effort to tell and prove what I now so suddenly had become, but it seemed of no use, as I could not even so much as flutter an eyelid. As I lay all resigned to my position, waiting to be released with full strength, one of the old house nurses who had attended me so faithfully, came in at this hour to see how I did. She did not stay long, however, but rushed back with a body of others and a young physician. You see for yourself, doctor, she said, sadly, she is dead. I told you as much. A great dreadful chill of intense agony crept over me. I was no more dead than she, but merely hopelessly helpless. And there they tarried and at last decided that I was dead. Like one that is dead I lay, like a white corpse indeed awaiting burial. I saw and heard all the preparation for my burial, saw my dear husband and baby girl come and stand by my cold winding sheet. So many thousands of miles he had travelled to be at my funeral. He almost grieved his heart away because I had died before I had regained my reason. Oh, Lord of hosts, how fervently I did pray then to be given the strength and use of my body until I could tell them that I lived and that I was soundly restored to sanity. But I could not. Oh, precious heaven, I could not. And so I lay in a very torpor of dread despair of terrible fear lest I should actually be buried alive. Ah, my friends, you who have never experienced this, cannot know just what it is, this fear of being buried alive. You may sympathize as you read but you cannot understand my most awful and intense suffering at this time. At last they came and laid flowers on my breast. Beautiful pink and white roses, but their odor sickened me and I made one more great but vain effort to speak. It seemed utterly useless. Then they laid me in a snowy hard white casket, and the crowd gathered around to listen to the gray-haired man of God giving my funeral service. Such writhing torments and horrors as I experienced through that sermon I cannot half explain to you, only that at the close as they passed around to view me for the last time I settled down into a state of desolate waiting for my fearful doom. At last my husband came and held up over my casket the tiny form of our beloved Grace Marie that she might see her mother, too, for the very last time. Oh, 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 Mama, she shrieked, wildly. Don't look all cold and dead that awful way, come, come and take me. Like lightning swiftness a warm power went shooting through my veins, and like a thunderclap I raised and strained my child to my shrouded breast. In all the commingling emotions of that heart clasp, I knew that I had succeeded in letting them know that I lived as did they and I was in raptures of thanksgiving. Then there came a blank like a dream that is past. And I stood there in the floor strong-limbed and free, and was the very embodiment of health and strength. Such a strange, glad feeling. I looked quickly in the direction of my casket, and wonder of wonders, there was my pale corpse clasping close my beautiful child. I saw them wrest my darling from the death grasp of those nerveless fingers, and settle the wasted body down close again in the casket's depths. A band of the departed soon came and explained that I was now a spirit as were they. I grew very contented and happy and went to dwell with them in peace. Long afterward they told me of the strange reason of my so-called insanity which was nothing more nor less than the spirit of an East Indian princess taking mortal possession of me to carry out revengeful ends in the closing scenes of her short earth life. And when this band succeeded in releasing me from her influence, was the very moment in which I became so physically transfixed. The shock of my baby's sorrow had awakened so intense and rather extreme circulation that the sudden reaction had snapped my vital part, that I passed into the reality of death instantly, only to have the pleasure of the eternal life forever and ever. I come to give you thanks for your forbearance, and depart with my blessing on your heads, yours for life in love. Religion of the Future. Denton. We venture to say that the new movement will spring from the spiritualistic ranks which by and by, All of the Orthodox will unhesitatingly recognize all of the spiritual teachings and reinterpret their doctrine in the spirit of the new. We hope there will be a reinterpretation of the old, and it is to be hoped that all religions will convincingly tend toward the same goal. Spiritualism will satisfy the essential needs of the human heart. You drift tempest-tossed on the ocean of life, and you need guidance and comfort and encouragement. In the face of the unrest which surrounds you, you want to have the assurance of a ground where your anchor can catch. You want to know your goal and the direction in which you have to steer. All of this must be supplied by spiritual knowledge, and where your knowledge is insufficient, faith steps in. Spirituality is inborn in every soul in the same way as gravity is inalienably part of all matter. Everything is a particle that exists interlinked with the whole of the cosmos. It is swayed by it, it is attached to it, its momentum is determined by it in the exact proportion of its weight, of its position, and generally of its relation to the universe. The innate energy of every particle, every atom presses forth in one direction or another beyond its own limits, as if it were yearning beyond itself. No piece of matter is existence in itself. Its nature and its movements are conditioned by the rest of the universe, and it can find the fulfillment of its belonging only outside its own energy. In the same way, every sentient soul yearns beyond itself and becomes easily conscious of the fact that it is only a part of an immeasurably great whole, that stretches forth into unknown infinitudes, and that the significance of its life lies outside the sphere of its ego. Spiritualism is so strong that it may be counted as the deepest passion of which man is capable. It is possessed of a motive power which excels all other passions, and can, if misdirected, lead to deeds which otherwise would be impossible, such as sacrifice of one's self or of one's own deity who is believed to demand such offerings. Spiritualism enters into every fiber of man's spiritual existence, and throughout the development of human actions it remains the factor which adjusts the relation of the individual to the all-important factor. It grows and matures with the growth and maturity of man. It weaves out of his experiences a world of conceptions in which it appoints him to his place, assigns his duties, and furnishes his direction for his conduct. The functions of spiritualism, however, go deeper still. Your entire world is the actualization of eternal types which develop according to law, and brings into existence these possibilities which in philosophy are called Platonic ideas. Accordingly, man is not a mere congeries of atoms, he is more than a corporal conglomeration of matter, he is the actualization of the type of his personality. His essential and characteristic being consists in the ideas he thinks, in the aims he pursues, and in the significance which he possesses for the great movement of human life. Life is eternal and has made its appearance in corporeal and visible shape, and no thinking man will ultimately deny the existence of another life. Spiritualism reminds you of the eternal background against which the fleeting phenomena of the material world take shape. This eternal is the essential part of life, that transfigures the transient in which it is actualized. The higher man rises, the better he understands how to distinguish between faith and knowledge. In the dogmatic state, you are like children, being nursed with fairy tales and parables, but in the state of manhood you shall see face to face, and have a clear and unequivocal comprehension of the truth. When once one has caught some vision and hope of the fullness of life that spiritualism reveals, when he has seen some glimpses of the ideal spiritual realm to which its aspirations point, he is then concerned only in making that ideal a reality. No man becomes a saint by dreaming of heaven. Faith can never satisfy the longing soul. It is ever looking forward. He sees the promise of spring in the storms of winter. He sees the handiwork of nature and he finds the promise of full life everywhere. You are nearer to the psychical moment than you know. Revelations from the world of mind, the realm of the spiritual, are alike craved and claimed in all lines of life, religious, social and even political. You are not alone in this movement. No, far from it. You have on your earth level-headed men who give themselves openly to the study or acceptance of the physical phenomena, and as well from king to baronet, show revived interest and faith in the spiritual phenomena, but some writers, professors and preachers take up what someone calls the psychical craze and give their most matter-of-fact paragraphs and preachments to some phase of it. The mere possibility of such stories coming in these tunes from staid newspaper correspondents and finding such accepting the daily statements of press, shows what a change has come upon the public mind since the days when ghost stories of this nature were whispered mainly in the fireside corners and confidential gossip guarded by strict pledges against a scoffing world. Spiritual phenomena are subjects of special interest to the intellectual world at the present time, mainly as it relates to the spiritual laws for the formation of a correct man and also, a correct government for all men. Even the tremendous question of life hereafter is held in abeyance before the vital interest in grasping the relation of the spiritual laws and forces to the earth life. Christian Science, Mental Science, New Thought, etc. are all relative to spiritual laws and controlled wholly by spiritual influences. The psychic teacher will serve to illustrate the question of the occasional opening of man's normal vision to the knowledge of the existence of spiritual beings, and further to show the purpose of such awakening, as well as to explain the nature of it. He says, the human eye and ear are tuned to the perception of waves or vibrations of light and sound traveling at velocities that have been measured. There are vibrations below those to which the eye and ear are attuned, of which man is absolutely unconscious. Yet such vibrations do exist. It is true that the lower you go in the scale of vibration, the more nearly you approach the inorganic world. On the other hand, the higher you go in the inorganic world, the higher you go in the scale of vibration and the closer you come to unknown forces and to the brink of a world that forces itself upon your consciousness. There is no obstacle to force vibrating at high velocities, as light penetrates glass it penetrates any organic matter. And the soul, the spirit, the ego, partakes of the qualities of these forces and to a much higher degree may be a legitimate deduction. Commonly, it is its disembodied state that is looked to as the one to put it into the active exercise of these forces. But that sometimes even while in the body bent, it breaks through the muddy vesture of decay and touches the unknown keys of harmony and omnipotence in the universe of pure power, the history of genius itself testifies, as well as the indisputable evidence of psychic power and phenomena which the scholars and scientists now recognize, and are, above all else concerned to investigate. All poets have signalized their consciousness of rare moments, when they were superior to themselves, when a light, a freedom, a power came to them which lifted them to performances they were wholly unable to reach at other times. Your inspiration comes from the higher forces and sometimes from the higher spheres of spiritual truth, and touches the plane where life means something powerful, and that can only be measured by eternity. These forces make you feel first of all the indifference of circumstances. That you have called in other than material forces to your aid, is the thing that makes you a strength and an inspiration to mankind, as all the psychic teachers of today are conspiring to set forth. The swinging of time's pendulum in the direction of the psychical, is clearly indicated by introducing experiments in psychic phenomena into students' classrooms, and bespeaking truth for media mystic demonstrations, and by this trend of all thought and philosophy, to locate human power and achievement in the mental or spiritual forces. Science is merely searching the sixth sense in man, and the spiritual moment that may break in upon this great mystery is perchance not so far distant. The spiritual viewpoint which has been dimly presented to man by teachers and mystics of long ages, may at length declare itself in man's consciousness, which is a point to revolutionize the whole life problem. How many writers whose prophetic souls disclose the might and meaning of this spiritual awakening? There are hundreds who are alive to the force of this distinction in the unveiling of spiritual truth to man, and who follow the vision to its surest heights of blessedness and power in the uplifting of mankind. This unveils the glad realms of life and power to man, and in all-embracing joy of it, no dismal goadings of conscience that marked the darkened hour find any place. Once the veil is lifted between man and the place where joy resides at the heart of creative being, all is well. It is ignorance that makes error and all its haunting monitors in man's pathway. It may be that in the time of ignorance, conscience is the little spark of celestial fire that struggles to light the way to the true haven of spiritual truth. But once the vision is made clear, the narrow mission of science is at an end. If you wish to reform a man, do not tell him that he is a sinner, show him who and what he is, and he will reform himself, aye, and if he holds the balance of power in his hands he will reform the world, which is directly in line with spiritual laws, and one who gives the true vision with his means to forward it, it would surely know how to meet all the difficulties the short-sighted ones he could conjure up in his pathway. It is more than a faith which is original as the spiritualists acknowledge it, that illumines your presentation of the case. It is a truth that is mighty to save by anchoring itself in leaders on the heights of the struggle in the firing line of truth. This is a truth that has been given to the people from the creation of your world, and no great thing was ever accomplished in your world without inspiration, but lacking the means to make his inspiration available in the life of men, many a seer and medium have missed the end of his vision. When the light breaks at the top of the world, and the men who see the best things, have power to bring them to pass, the millennium should not be far distant by whatever name the brethren are pleased to call it. Meantime, the undercurrent of interest in spiritual things pertaining to the higher forces perceptible everywhere, must naturally prepare the way for men and women of genius who can focus and interpret the psychic or spiritual movement, and turn it to the highest service of mankind. That it shall bring a glimpse of the truth on earth for which weary, heavy-laden men and women as well as the dwarfed and misdirected children of men, may well thank the spirits and their mediums. The Church is in the midst of one of the most appalling crises in its history. The reason is of its false teachings, as it claims of radical criticism, and in the name of scholarship, whereas, the enemies of the past have been the reporters chiefly of outsiders, the present enemies are inside leaders in a great scholastic apostasy entrenched in foremost positions in pulpits, in the press, in educational institutions and even in theological seminaries. Once the great aim of religious endeavor was to bring all men to church adherence, to confession of one or the other of the faiths. They have been working at that for centuries, and there remains just about as much real sin in the world as ever, there remains as much unnecessary misery, as much injustice and wrong. The world is far from being saved. The founders of Christianity taught men to be patient, meek peacemakers, pure in heart, neighborly, sincere, just, loyal to their best ideas. His followers could not content themselves with things as simple as these. They sought out subtleties, they taught men to dispute over historical and traditional data, they proclaimed that men would be saved by faith. There are many who call themselves preachers of the gospel, whose good news consists in this, that men have only to force themselves into mental activity to accept this or the other faith or tradition, and they will have accomplished the will on high, they will have saved their own souls. Do you mean to say that you have a moral universe, where the one great thing required is that men should believe some things they can know nothing about? To tell the thief, the swindler, the liar, the bankrupt and the social outlaw that what the great judge of all requires of them is nothing more than that they should believe some chapter in the Bible, history, or some theory in some celestial place, may have indeed been the sound of good news to them. This seems a cheap and easy escape from the terrors of the law without the rigor of justice. The religion that is to save the world is spiritualism which underlies right action, that which burns itself into the depths of a man and forces him to follow the truth, to serve the right, to battle wrong, to succor need, to give all he has, even life itself, for noble ends. Do you believe in goodness, right, justice, love, truth, and to choose spiritualism as your guidepost? Now do you admire these principles? If you do, follow them. This is the truth that will save the world and be the coming religion. Man's possessions. Stephen Terhune. The universe is boundless and unerring, its revelations are implicit in all the processes of nature, and explicit too, so far as human vision, in mortals is concerned. Men of science have not been as yet sufficiently cleared and strengthened to perceive all of the spiritual forces given to man, to consider what is involved in the idea of evolution and progress, as applied to the whole universe. The spiritual forces are facts, or, are they dreams? If they are facts, what illuminating facts they are. Your world is but a stage, and men and women play their parts. You see, in the mighty process of evolution, an eternal struggle toward more and more self-perception, and fuller and more all-embracing existence, not only the part of what is customarily spoken of as creation, but insofar as nature is an aspect of man's spiritual nature. So far as science is concerned, you must dare to extend the thought of growth, progress and development tip to the highest of all that you can realize of the spiritual laws, and your own struggles and efforts, and disappointments and aspirations, are evidence of the effort toward fuller, completer and more conscious existence. The Christian idea of God is not omnipresent, omniscient and omnipotent. If it were, Christians would not believe as they do, that God is self-determined and complete. Our God is love, who yearns, who suffers, who enters into storm and conflict, and is subject to conditions as the soul of it, all conditional, not artificial and transitory, but inherent in the process of producing force and conscious beings, and essential to full self-development. Friends, did you ever stop to think of the adversities that uncover the riches of life? You might never know their real value but for the less worthy things you have valued too highly. You might never know how rich you really were, but for the harsh hands that despoil you of that which you once counted as riches. The piercing sorrows are the ones that break through the crust of life and open their worth under the surface. You do not find out what is in you until you lose a dear one that you dearly loved. You learn in time to bless the hand that seemed so cruel when it took her from some sheltered nook and compelled you to battle with naked fists against the world. Destitution of natural things is the fate that awaits you all. Some may know it during life and in some measure, its losses must be in every life, while all must someday lose the grip on earthly things, and must bid farewell to all its possessions, and carry out of your early stage of being, only your own selves. When the real men, the spirit is freed from all earthly burdens, it is surprising to see how much remains. The man is here with his will, memory, imagination, his power to create and to conquer, to make riches of the heart to heart, to win friends, to enter into fellowship with the spirits of all ages, to appreciate and possess the universe of things that are eternal and imperishable. Life is just what you make it on the earth, plane, or spiritual plane. Neither pain nor poverty nor even death can come to you. The secret of earth life is the discovery of spirit life, which is eternal. Your abiding place here is unfading riches, the perennial blossoms, the streams that flow forever, and follow you all through the desert. Science, spiritualism, theology. William Denton. Friends, you must bear in mind that there is the widest possible distinction between the facts witnessed by spiritual records or demonstrations, which are plain statements, and the interpretation which we have been accustomed to place upon these facts that have been associated in our minds for ages, and the modes of expression with which we have been clothed, as set forth by us. And the conclusions be proved to which spiritual science or its phenomena seem to point, then it is found at the most to contradict some preconceived notions which you have been used to read, or traditional modes which you have accepted in interpreting it. We will say that even if the spiritualists were convinced of inaccuracies as to some matters of detail, that of itself would no more disprove the truth of essential matters revealed, than the inaccuracies being detected in any other channel. The conclusion to which the course of all scientific observation seems to tend, is that all the complex phenomena of your world are due to simple, original causes which, however once set in motion, have been working through progressive and well-marked evolutionary stages from the first nebulous condition to which you may trace primary matter up to a point where all further evolution has been arrested. The nebulous matter out of which this visible order of the universe was formed, has been the debris of former organized worlds, as astronomy now appears to indicate. The great facts which alone are material to the purpose, are plainly and simply stated, that the elements of which your world and the people are composed, were once in a nebulous and disorganized condition. The controlling intelligence called them into being first, then placed them under the active operation of forces which evolved by successive stages, the complex world that you have around you.